From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. L.A. teachers are back in the classroom this morning. They ratified a deal with the L.A. Unified School District that, at least on paper, met several union demands. However, there's a big question over how the district will pay for significant class size reduction and the salaries of substantially more nurses, counselors, and librarians. We'll go in-depth on the deal right after the news.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering an evening master's in clinical psychology program with an MFT. Priority deadline to apply is February 18th at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us today. I so appreciate with all the different things you can listen to on radio, on podcast, that you choose to spend at least a portion of 2 hours with us here each day on Air Talk. Coming up in our second hour, we'll look at the effects of the LA teachers' strike. We'll talk with listeners who've been part of labor disputes, either on the employee or the management side. What types of tensions continued even after the dispute was settled? What helped bring people together after the emotional fallout of a labor dispute or strike? So if you've been there, either 30 years ago with LA Unified, its last strike in 1989, or whether you've had a recent dispute on the job, please call in during our 11 o'clock hour. But first, let's look at the nuts and bolts of the deal between LA Unified and UTLA, the union, with SKPECC education reporter Kyle Stokes. Kyle, good morning. How are you holding up through all? You don't look too tired.
A lot of baling wire and spit and duct tape at this point.
So. Yeah, you're a resilient young man. You look look all ready to go with another round. So yeah. Let's jump into this. Why don't we start with sort of the easy part of this to tackle? The salary increase, 6%. How much retroactive? How much going forward?
Yeah, 3% retroactive, 3% going forward. This was not a huge point of contention in late stages of talks. The teachers had been hoping for 6.5% with back pay all the way back to 2016, to July of 2016. They didn't get that. Essentially, they accepted the district salary offer.
All right. And the LA Board of Education, the County Board of Education, they're still a player in this, right? Do they have to actually sign off that this is fiscally responsible for the district to agree to this?
They do get a chance to weigh in, and they do get a chance to review the deal, and they, in fact, have to put together, the district has to put together for the county, and the county has to assess a picture of how this affects the school district's finances. What is the overall cost of this deal? The reason why that matters a lot right now is because the school district is currently under county supervision, has been appointed a fiscal expert to sort of assist in writing a cost-cutting plan. It's basically the first step on the road to something more serious if the district doesn't get its act together, up to and including something like a county takeover where the county appoints an official that can override school district decisions and budget decisions. We're very far from that point right now, but that is to say that this labor agreement, which the county has said they're concerned about some of the spending that is in it, that it could be done out of one-time reserves, the county might have something to say about this deal, and so they have 10 days to review it and have promised to do their review with all speed.
Now, I know teachers are back in the classroom today, so that means that many teachers who could join us to talk about what they think of the deal aren't necessarily available, but maybe you're a substitute teacher in the district and you're home today, driving around, you have a chance to join us and share your thoughts. I'm interested, if you are involved at all in the deal between the union and the district, to share your thoughts. 866-893 KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. We asked Union President Alex Caputo Pearl to join us, declined to join us on the program today. LAUSD Superintendent Austin Buettner also declined to join us today. But you got an exclusive with Mayor Garcetti, Kyle.
I did get a chance to sit down with Mayor Eric Garcetti this morning. Obviously, his office and the mayor personally was very involved in late stage negotiations, really got involved in the sort of last last week or so. I believe it was on Thursday now, although the days are blending together here. But on Thursday, where the mayor's office announced that talks would be back on, that the mayor's office would facilitate those talks. And at the time that those talks came together, this was part of what we talked about earlier this morning. The mayor said at the time that this all came together, most of the negotiations weren't happening in the bargaining sessions. A lot of them were actually happening in the press.
You can't build a relationship and you can't negotiate the details of a labor contract in the press. We love openness and accountability, and I think it was important for people to see. But I was very surprised how little communication was going on, not only between principals, but one level down from that. Oftentimes, people will be deputized that even when relations are bad, to keep communication channels open, and they just weren't.
Yeah, it was surprising for me to hear that, you know, he talked about before this that he thought that this was going to be very easy, that they weren't that far apart on the issues. And when you consider the fact that this was just as much an intrapersonal dispute, or like, you know, basically a clash of personalities and a question of negotiating in the press as well as of issues, getting those two, locking those two sides into a room appears to have made a difference.
Well,
here.
Each side questioned the other's motives, and I think so. Then it's difficult. If each side perceives it's about more than just the issues that are under dispute, but attributes to the other side a sort of value difference that they think, you know, undermines the good of students. And I think that's fair to say. Both sides sort of saw each other that way. Certainly Alex Caputo-Pearl, president of UTLA, is said of Austin Buettner, the superintendent. He believes that he intends to make the district more and more charter friendly and fewer right. neighborhood schools. And I think on the board and on the district side, there was a lot of belief that Alex Caputo-Pearl was using this sort of a launching pad for himself as much as anything.
Right. I mean, so two fundamental reasons that the two sides could distrust each other, and that was definitely a factor in all of this. And it was probably, I mean, it was one of the reasons that these talks dragged on over 2 years. There were also just very basic disagreements over how much money that the district had to spend on this contract. Remember, this whole debate over the $2 billion reserve and whether the district was hoarding it or not hoarding it, whether they should be spending it. What the mayor came in and said was that what he said to me this morning was that he looked at the budget and said there is some common space. You know, the district obviously has its financial challenges, but his words were that there was some space in the budget for the district to spend on the union's demands, and that he felt like the district couldn't be conservative in a moment like this and needed to spend on some of these demands.
Kyle, I learned from I just said Alex Caputo-Pearl would not join us. He's agreed to join us. He'll be on in about 8 minutes.
So. Great.
Alex, thank you. Maybe you heard that. Glad you're going to be with us. But as you report, the third year of this deal, 2021-22,
right.
The cost jumps significantly because there you're looking at even more ambitious cuts in class size. You're looking at ramped up hiring for counselors, teachers, nurses for the district. How are they going to fund this?
Well, it's sort of a leap of faith, as the mayor said at the beginning of this. I mean, I think that there is a certain amount of the money that is there right now. The district was planning to spend $130 million on class size reduction over the next year. That was their initial offer. Now they're going to spend $175 million over 2 years on class size reduction and on hiring more nurses, counselors, and school librarians. That third year, again, it does get more expensive, but this is what the mayor calls the leap of faith. And that was sort of a much laughed at quote by some of us in the education world. We're like, what is this guy talking about, a leap of faith? But it appears that the district is ready to take that leap of faith, that we're going to find the funding in some future year, either through some more state funding, through perhaps a local property tax or other revenue generating measure here locally. And the mayor said this morning that he is open to supporting such a measure.
Well, that is a leap of faith, though, because you've got to count the state revenues continue at their record high. We don't know what's going to happen with the economy. And the revenue here, as you know, Kyle, heavily dependent on investment income for the highest earners. It's a highly progressive way of raising revenue. The other issue is if they're going to go to voters with a parcel tax, or I know there's the state initiative for what's called a split roll to where commercial property, the assessed valuations would go up separate from Prop 13 limits. That's all going to be potentially a tough sell to voters. So they're kind of betting that things are going to line up and go their way.
Right. And that's the leap of faith part of this. But the mayor said this morning that you have to sort of, you know, you have to offer a positive vision, essentially, of what the school district is going to be for. You've got to basically make it so that you spend a little up front, hoping that families also reinvest. I mean, we talk about all of the revenue situation, the funding situation. Remember, this is still a district with declining enrollment and deeply, you know, deep set financial challenges that are go well beyond what the reserve is for now and for the next 3 years, what the numbers are on paper. Revenue enrollment is still declining. And that means that, you know, in the mayor's view, it's time for this district to try and take a leap of faith that the funding is going to materialize.
Kyle, what about the regulations on charter schools? Because another fundamental, I think it's fair to say, educational value difference between the two sides is over charters and what they represent. To UTLA, what charters represent is little oversight, iffy results, and taking money away from neighborhood schools. The district position that charter schools, providing that option to parents, is serving the children and parents of the district. So how does this change under the deal?
Well, so the deal doesn't change a ton of this. There are some charter school regulations as part of the deal, particularly related to charter schools that share LAUSD campuses. The deal also appears to include that the school board is going to vote on a resolution calling on state lawmakers to impose a cap on charter schools in Los Angeles. That's only something that state lawmakers can deal with. So the board, you know, it's going to be interesting this moment because it is a board that, you know, where most of the members on it have been endorsed at one point by the California Charter Schools Association, and it's possible that they might have to vote for a resolution that calls for an end to charter growth in Los Angeles, at least for the time being. To your point, though, about like how much is this part of the deal? It wasn't on the deal in a lot of places in the regulations, the letter of this new contract, but it is sort of a big reason why teachers wanted to strike. It's central to their anxieties about the future of the school district and why they felt like they needed to walk the picket line. So there are some nods to that in this deal.
Well, they clearly see charters as an existential threat, that as there's declining neighborhood school enrollment, fewer families can afford to live in the LA Unified School District, they're concerned about jobs.
And I should also mention the class size reduction piece. Teachers union supporters talked about class size reduction as an explicit defense against charter school co-location, against, because when you have more classrooms being used because your class sizes are smaller, that leaves fewer classrooms open to be shared with charter schools, which right now under state law, the district is compelled to do.
And a secondary benefit for the union beyond more manageable classes via size, more teachers employed as well. Mm-hmm. Joining us, Monica Garcia, who is the president of the LA Unified School District Board. Thank you for being with us on Air Talk.
Good morning.
Good morning. Obviously, you're happy this agreement's reached. Teachers back in the classroom today. First question is about, you know, ongoing rancor from this. You have concerns about the enmity that, you know, really came to the fore during the course of the strike and the negotiations?
You know, I have just experienced the beginning of healing with administrators who are recognizing that individuals, groups, schools, our community, we have all experienced some level of trauma. Whether we were energized and we felt this has been decades coming, or we were newbies to the first time in our life, there is a pause that must happen for human beings. And I am certain, you know, just like all the other emotions, there was a lot of love, the power of risking your salary, risking your wellness, joining with thousands on the outside, and really focusing on who you are and what you want and coming to work to make sure kids had what they needed. So I am welcoming compassion. I am welcoming all of the seasoned veterans that lived through 1998 or 89.
Yeah, boy, that was rancorous.
And, you know, the walkouts, we just heard 50 years later how many people still live in that moment and experienced harsh, unforgiving absent compassion. I think 50 years later, we've understood diversity better. We've understood that there has to be room for all of us. I find that, yes, there will be a period for personal and group transition, but I am hopeful that really, you know, I said it day one, inside, outside, we're all on the same side, We are really all talking about how to support more and better in the classrooms of Los Angeles.
Let's talk about the charter change here, because there really was limited ability for neighborhood school sites to fight charter schools being co-located on those campuses. Now there's going to be the ability of the local teaching staff, of parents that are have their kids attending those neighborhood schools, to fight having charters placed there. Is that going to have an effect of slowing the creation of new charters? You're making it more difficult for them to find locations.
So let's see. I think this is exactly like we have to helicopter up and we have to understand what are we all trying to do. If we're all trying to build the new public school that has that meets all students' needs, that meets all families' needs, that welcomes families of all classes and parts of the district, then we have to not focus on the fight for against each other, but really what everybody said, 43rd in the nation, not good enough, California. The campuses that we have, even though we voters have supported building new schools and modernization, we have to take this conversation towards what do children need and why do we have one system with a lot of rules and a lot of debt and another system with a lot of flexibility and a lot of, you know, start from scratch.
But my question is, what these schools, as you put it, that have this kind of flexibility, are they going to not have so much flexibility in finding a place to have their schools?
So we've got 50,000 children whose families choose charters on our campuses already. There's a lot of examples of how we have figured it out. What I hope is that, yes, there will be more conversation of how in 2019 do people plan forward. And so there are, you know, fewer children. Parents want choice. That is just true, whether it's our magnet program, pilot schools, charter schools. But parents also want more support for teachers and students.
All right. Monica Garcia, thank you for being with us. We appreciate it very much. President of the LA Unified School District joining us, the Board of Education. As we continue, we'll get a parental perspective. We'll also talk with the president of the California Charter School Association. What do they think about changes for charter approvals on district neighborhood schools? And we'll talk with Alex Caputo-Pearl, the president, United Teachers Los Angeles. Kyle Stokes, KPCC education reporter as well. How do we fit everybody in here? We're going to do it. We'll be back with more On Air Talk in just 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Larry Mantle with KPCC K through 12 education reporter Kyle Stokes joining us now, the president of United Teachers Los Angeles, the union representing LA Unified Teachers, Alex Caputo-Pearl. Good to have you with us today.
Thanks for having me.
So obviously you're gratified, if not caught up on sleep at this point after all the overnight negotiating of the past few days. But let's talk about some of the specifics here. Some of the biggest class size reductions and staffing increases come in the third year of this contract, 2021-22. Where do you see the money coming from to fund that?
Well, obviously, the district is comfortable with spending monies out of the reserve and other places that they have within the current budget. One of the great things that came out of these talks is a shared commitment to get behind schools and communities first, which is the ballot initiative in November of 2020 that reforms Proposition 13, closes the corporate loophole. But really, what we see this agreement as overall is a huge win for students, educators, parents, and public district schools. We got rid of the provision that actually allowed the district to continue to blow through class size caps whenever it wanted to. That's gone. It starts an aggressive program of class size reduction over the next few years, and we're going to be able to expand on that. 300 nurses coming in, 80 librarians coming in, a 500-to-1 student-to-counselor ratio, first-time language for parents and educators to have input around charter co-locations, and investment in a community schools model that is shaping the national conversation about how parents, schools, and communities work together. So this is a real big win.
Well, and it's understandable UTLA would want the teachers at a neighborhood campus and the parents to be able to have a say about a charter co-locating and coming in and using available space. But what's to keep UTLA from seeing this as a way to fight the perception that charters are an existential threat overall to neighborhood schools? So you've got the potential, a neighborhood school is going to be used. UTLA potentially organizes, you know, gets the faculty at that school and parents, organized around fighting back against the charter. What's to keep that from happening at each of these neighborhood schools and preventing charters going forward from co-locating at all?
Well, we're not hiding the fact that the unregulated growth of charter schools continues to be a huge problem. All of the research is saying, and you can look at Gordon Lafer's report called Spending Blind, all of the research says that we have enough schools in Los Angeles right now. There's no reason to be running a business model that just tries to bring in more and more and more charter schools when we have enough space and we have enough schools. We need to exist. We need to invest in our existing schools. And what you saw behind this movement were tens of thousands of parents getting involved on picket lines, in rallies downtown, over 60,000 people downtown, 3 days out of five during a work week. It shows the incredible passion behind invest in our existing public schools. We don't need more unregulated charter growth. So we're not running away from that at all, and the Board of Education is going to be considering a motion by Richard Vladovic to call on the state to put a moratorium on new charter school growth. We don't think that's anything about a charter versus public war. We think it's common sense. There's enough schools in Los Angeles.
What I'm hearing you say, correct me if I'm wrong, as a practical matter, whenever there's going to be a proposal to co-locate charter students at a neighborhood school, UTLA is going to fight that.
Well, what we have in contract language right now, in legally binding contract language, is that the district has to inform us in December about any schools that are targeted for co-location. That gives time for, you know, just what you would consider to be respectful notice to parents that their public district school may be a target for co-location. Of course, those parents may get involved in asking questions about that, pushing back on that. And certainly educators would be a part of that as well. If you have parent centers taken away by charter schools, dance studios taken away by charter schools, et cetera. But I really think the overall message here is that this strike, and frankly, we went to a strike because it was a last resort, but people would not have become as motivated around school funding issues and all of these nurse, counselor, librarian issues if we had not gone on strike. This strike was such a positive development for the city of Los Angeles, and we need to grab that opportunity now and take the next steps around school funding and common sense charter regulation.
We're talking with Alex Caputo-Pearl, the president, United Teachers Los Angeles, the union representing the district teachers. Settlement was reached in overnight negotiations early yesterday morning, and then teachers returned to the classroom today. Alex, do you have projections on what the effects of the smaller class size are going to be on teacher hiring and or attrition, as well as the support staff of nurses, counselors, and librarians? How many additional individuals would be hired as a part of that?
Well, we know that there'll be 300 nurses hired, 80 librarians hired, 17 counselors hired, and that'll all happen. That'll all begin pretty quickly. The numbers of teachers needed for the class size reduction is being calculated. We're working with the district on that, and we're gratified to be working with the district on that. And we'll be letting you know that. The other thing that comes out of this, and this comes from the incredible parent and community and youth groundswell who saw this strike as a social movement, is we actually have an agreement to expand the pilot program that reduces the number of random searches, which have been criticized for being racial profiling. It's going to double the schools that reduce that, and instead we'll have city services provided by the mayor going in for school safety, which is fantastic. We also have an expansion of green space at schools that was worked out in this agreement. We can't have schools that are concrete slabs. We need schools that actually have green space for kids, that are attractive to parents. And then we also are so gratified that coming out of this agreement, we're going to be working with the district on establishing an immigrant defense fund to make sure that we've got money for district families that are facing attacks from the Trump administration, that we can help them legally, et cetera. So this is a social compact that has come out of this agreement, and it comes out of a social movement, and we're very happy about that.
And you're comfortable with those funds being used for family legal services, even though it's not related to education?
This will be raised charitably, so it actually
okay.
is going to be district funding, but it's going to be a district commitment to work with us and other organizations to raise charitable funds.
Also with me, KPCC reporter Kyle Stokes.
Alex, wanted to ask you, I spoke with Mayor Eric Garcetti this morning, and he said that before his getting involved in negotiations, a lot of the actual talks were happening through the press, and that's something you've obviously criticized Superintendent Buettner for doing. But the mayor says both sides were sort of complicit in this practice. Do you agree with that? Will you own up to the fact that a lot of the talks until this move to City Hall were happening in the press?
Look, that's water under the bridge. Certainly, we're very self-reflective, and when we do things that we could have done better, we try to change those. Garcetti's involvement was very important. We're gratified about that. I'm glad that we were able to spend the time with Austin Buettner and work these things out, and we're looking forward to pressing forward. We certainly have disagreements, and there are certainly going to be struggles. But the fact that Garcetti came in and helped Austin Buettner and I and our teams work things out was a very good move.
We're talking with Alex Caputo-Pearl. He's the president, United Teachers Los Angeles, on Air Talk. Let me also bring into the conversation from the California Charter School Association, CEO and President Mirna Castrejon. Ms. Castrejon, thank you for being with us. Your thoughts, particularly about the co-location of charters on neighborhood school campuses, how this change is going to affect that?
Well, that's a very interesting provision within the contract negotiations. And by the way, Alex, congratulations. I sincerely, putting the focus on the need for investment and a call to action on public education was a very good thing for Los Angeles. In the end, the state law is constructed in a way that affirms that charter school students are co-located at campuses that are also public school students in public school buildings. We absolutely know that as President Garcia noted, there are certainly refinements that can be done to on the district side for involving stakeholders into conversations so that the receiving school and the co-locating charter school can set the conditions for a more productive co-location. And there certainly are opportunities there for ensuring that those co-locations result, in fact, in better collaboration and are, in fact, bridges between both sectors. But in the end, this negotiation does not trump state law, and we will be continuing to follow the implementation of these new contract provisions to make sure that we are working toward the best collaboration possible.
Well, what I hear in that is the potential for legal showdowns then over the use of the space of district schools. If this is a state law versus contract language here between the local district and the union, as we continue on Air Talk, I want to get into that issue. We're talking with Mirna Castrejon, who's the head of the California Charter School Association. Also with us, Alex Caputo-Pearl, the president, United Teachers Los Angeles. Monica Garcia is the president of the Board of Education, LA Unified. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPEC. WCC reporter Kyle Stokes with me as well. If you have questions or comments you want to make, you can join us at 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722. And coming up later in this hour, we're going to talk about the U.S. Supreme Court's decision that they're going to hear a challenge to a gun control law in New York, first big Second Amendment case for the court in nearly a decade. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3, back after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurtis. So good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We're talking about the ramifications of the deal between the L.A. Unified School District and its teachers. Teachers back on the job today. I bet a lot of hugs between parents, maybe even students and teachers. Any complaints you might have heard before probably falling by the wayside as the familiar teachers return to the classroom today. But we're talking about what this contract means going forward. One of the issues is co-location of charter schools on district campuses where teachers really limited or parents to block charters being co-located on those neighborhood school campuses when there was available space. Now, under this new contract, there's the opportunity for teachers, parents, students to try and block the co-location of charter schools. Now, we're talking with Myrna Costrejon, who is the president and CEO of the California Charter School Association. For the break, she just pointed out that state law says that charters essentially have the right to be able to use these campuses when it's logistically feasible. So, Myrna, are we looking at potential lawsuits between charters wanting use of the space and teachers and parents trying to fight it off?
Well, look, we're less than 24 hours into the resolution of this strike. And the reality of this is that this conversation is really just starting. What I do want to point out, Larry, right now is that there's less than 70% of district schools are actually co-located. This is not like a universal issue that we're struggling through. And these are actually places where we can realize the promise of sharing best practices. The reality is we have more than enough examples where there's good collaboration that actually has not only increased enrollment in the host school, but actually really creative opportunities to improve facilities for both, like STEM Prep that actually resulted in increased enrollment at 24th Street in Barrendo, and building a gym for both. Gabriela, a great example of a very collaborative co-location as well. I simply want to push back against the notion that every co-location and all of this issue around facilities and its usage of the public, of these public assets, is necessarily a zero-sum win or lose proposition, and that we are escalating issues, because that is not the spirit that we are building to this. We simply want to remind folks that as exciting as it is to have come on the other side of a very contentious but also energizing strike, that we are just beginning the conversation at all levels to include other stakeholders.
All right.
The contract was resolved between two parties. Parents were not at the table. Charter schools were not at the table. And ultimately, voters with no children and LAUSD were not at the table. And all of these issues will end up including and engaging all of us in different layers of advocacy and policy.
We're talking with Myrna Costrejon, President and CEO of California Charter School Association. Han, in Westchester, you wanted to weigh in on the charter school issue.
Yes, I'm very concerned that UTLA and many others are trying to place the blame on charter schools. I think that charter schools are being mischaracterized because they're not the cause of bad schools. I think that they're the symptom of a failing school district. And to me, I kind of liken it to almost like a food stamp situation where everybody knows that, for instance, that food stamps are not the solution to changing hunger in America. They are sort of a essential triage response to, like, the immediate problems. But the long-term solution is, for instance, like reforming the way education is funded and maybe rooting out some of the problems with the district. But charter schools are providing people who, like low-income kids who don't have access to quality education, it gives them a chance to find someplace different. Like that isn't a private school that they can't afford.
It really— Han, I appreciate it. Thanks very much. Alex Caputo-Pearl, president, UTLA, your response to the listener, Han's comment about charters.
Yeah, and that's what this agreement does. It actually reinvests in our public district schools in a way that is an unmitigated improvement for students, for parents, for schools, and educators. So really the focus needs to be on reinvesting in our existing schools. Again, there's in a school district and in a state, well, certainly in a school district that has enough schools, there's no place for a business model that's trying to expand. Existing charter schools, that's another question. Obviously, they should be held accountable to the same standards. They should have to equitably serve all students, like special education students, English language learners, et cetera. Many of them don't. But the existing charter schools are a different question. This issue of a moratorium or a cap is about common sense, just saying we don't need more schools in Los Angeles. There's enough buildings, there's enough people, and now we've got to reinvest in those existing schools.
JSK writes on the AirTalk page, co-location removes a great obstacle to forming charters in expensive areas. And Tom in Hancock Park writes, my son goes to a charter only because the school he's assigned to in my neighborhood is rated a 2 out of 10 on great schools. If it weren't for charters, we'd be forced to move to a better school district because private schools aren't an option for us. You can share your comments on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. So, Kyle, this leaves you with a great deal to cover coming out of this deal, charters being just one of the issues. Funding also, there are tremendous obstacles towards these additional revenue sources.
And a lot of just sort of fallout from the mere fact that the district has put a little bit more money on the table and what this affects the district's long-term budget outcome. That's part of this. Interested to see how the co-location, regulations play out. I'm personally very interested in how this pilot's effort to open 30 community schools is going to go. These are schools the idea of a community school is that it becomes a hub for social services, but it also it is embedded in the concept is it raises up teacher voice in running the school. And under the deal here with the district, the pilot program will involve union members having a little bit more say in how school site budgets are spent. I'm interested to see how that pilot program works out. It could be an interesting concept.
Yeah, so the wraparound services are provided on the campus, and teachers have a larger say into how education takes place. That's going to be a very interesting experiment to see. Alex Caputo-Pearl, just real quickly before I let you go, are there models of these community schools with wraparound services that are working very well elsewhere?
Yeah, we've been working with community organizations and parents looking at Cincinnati, Austin, Texas, Baltimore, and some other places. And just in response to Myrna, parents have been at the bargaining table. We've been working for over 2 years. Parents helped us develop our contract proposals. Youth helped us develop them. Community organizations did. They've been to the bargaining table. There's an enormous amount of ownership. Tens of thousands of parents and community and youth didn't come out to picket lines because they didn't know anything about this. They came out because they're invested in the process. They were a part of shaping demands, and they wanted to see a good outcome. So we look forward to this strike actually helping to build the social movement that we need to build common sense regulation on charters and get more funding and resources into our schools and into our students. And community schools is a key part of that. So we're going to continue that work with Cincinnati, Austin, Baltimore, and other places.
I want to thank you very much, Alex Caputo-Pearl, President, United Teachers Los Angeles. Our thanks to Monica Garcia, President of the L.A. School District Board of Education, Myrna Castrejon, California Charter School Association, and our own Kyle Stokes. Kyle, thank you for joining me for this, working through all the complexities terms of the contract. Appreciate your reporting.
You're so welcome.
Kyle Stokes, you'll be reading his work at LAist.com and hearing him right here this afternoon on KPCC. More from his interview with LA Mayor Eric Garcetti right here on KPCC. Coming up, the U.S. Supreme Court taking up a Second Amendment issue, gun control versus gun rights in New York State. This is the first such case in nearly a decade for the High Court. Back with more in 1 minute. Pleasure to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. By the way, we're going to return to one of the issues raised by the strike in LA Unified. In our second hour, we're going to talk if you've been part of a labor dispute in the workplace, doesn't have to be education. How did you deal with the aftermath and relationships that were frayed, anger that came out, perhaps ongoing emotional strife between management and employees? We'll talk about that. I want to hear from those who were either on the management side or on the employee side. Hear your take on kind of what, if anything, healed it, and also some of the challenges in getting the organization back moving cohesively. But right now, our focus on yesterday's announcement by the U.S. Supreme Court that it will take up a right-to-carry gun control case. Now, this is the first big Second Amendment case that the court has taken up since the highly influential Heller decision, in which the court established there is a personal right to own a firearm in the home for self-defense. This case pits the New York State Rifle and Pistol Association against the city of New York. The case itself is a fairly narrowly targeted one, which has to do with people's ability to carry a firearm unloaded in the car outside of the city limits, but it could have broader repercussions generally on interpretation of the Second Amendment. With us is Columbia University School of Law Professor Jamal Green. Professor, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So briefly share with us what this restriction is in New York and why you think the court's willing to take this up.
So the restriction is really a kind of a quirky law. It's basically unique to New York City, where the city has a scheme where there are some people who have carry permits that enable them to carry handguns outside of their home, and that's a fairly limited number of people. And then others who have a premises permit who can have a handgun in the home. And they're allowed, people with the latter, the premises permit, are allowed to take a gun outside the home for certain limited purposes, one of which is to go to a shooting range. The plaintiffs here are saying that New York City's rule that says you can only carry them to shooting ranges inside the city is a violation of the Second Amendment. So it's a not especially burdensome rule, but also, you know, kind of a quirky law that isn't that well justified either. Why is the court taking this case? I think the best guess is the previous court had Justice Kennedy on it. He was in the majority in the Heller decision that you referenced, but there's been a lot of speculation that he's maybe a little bit softer on the Second Amendment than some of the other conservatives on the court. Now that he's been replaced by Justice Kavanaugh, there's potentially an opening to have a broader ruling involving carry laws. So the court has never weighed in on laws restricting the ability to carry a handgun outside of the home.
We're talking with Columbia University Professor Jamal Green, appropriately within New York City, of course. Also with us, UCLA a School of Law Professor Eugene Volokh. Professor, good to have you with us again. How much does the actual impact of this ban potentially have on the Supreme Court's decision versus the constitutional issue behind it, practical versus constitutional?
Well, it all turns on how it is that the court will decide the case. There may be very little practical impact from the decision if it just says, oh, this particular statute is unconstitutional because it's the only one in the country like this and there's not much of a justification for it. It could write a narrow opinion like that, but often a lot of the really important constitutional principles are set where there's one law on the table before the court. The court announces a more general rule. For example, it might say if you want to restrict a law-abiding citizen's possession of guns, then you need to have really solid evidence supporting the argument that this possession is somehow dangerous. If it were to announce that kind of rule, that could apply to lots of different gun controls, many of which are based on kind of what people see as common sense speculation more than evidence, or that are self-conscious attempts to experiment in order to try to generate evidence. So that's the kind of thing that could potentially set a much broader precedent. Likewise, if the Supreme Court says these kinds of laws are subject to so-called strict scrutiny, a very demanding standard of constitutional review, that could be pretty important. Or conversely, if it says, oh, a law like this imposes only a modest burden on people and therefore is subject only to so-called intermediate scrutiny, a kind of a more forgiving standard for government regulations, then that too could have an important precedential effect.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. It's sort of like who has the higher burden here? And Professor Green, let me go back to you. So, I actually looked up gun ranges in New York City because I thought, well, if you know, like here in Southern California, in urban areas, they're very limited just because it's very difficult to find a place for people to open up a range because there's so much opposition and land use issues. But there are actually quite a few gun ranges within the city limits of New York. So does that make it harder then for the plaintiffs challenging New York's law, because there are a lot of places they could go within the city with their firearm, you know, versus the city having to prove that this restriction actually has any impact on crime and violence whatsoever?
Right. It really, I think Professor Volokh does put his finger on it. There's a major question of right, who has the burden of proof here. As you note, New York City has seven ranges. There's at least one in each borough, and the lower court relied on that fact and said, you know, in order to say that this is a particularly burdensome law, you've got to say you don't really have a meaningful alternative to going outside the city, but here you do. So if you want to maintain the effectiveness of your training and so forth, you can do that at one of the ranges that's in the city. And so the plaintiffs are really just asking for an inconvenience to be relieved. Now, it may well be that an inconvenience is sufficient to trigger the Second Amendment if there's no good reason for the law. And what the city has said is the reason for restricting carrying by people with only premises licenses to ranges within the city is because it's really hard to prove where someone is going if the police just pick someone up and they have a firearm. And so that's basically the public safety rationale. So you've got a facially plausible but somewhat thin public safety rationale going against a fairly light burden on people who say, you know, I'd really like to be able to take my firearm to New Jersey or to upstate.
I'm wondering, though, how police would even discover the firearm, because now maybe it's different in New York, but in California, I believe that the unloaded firearm has to be carried in the trunk, if I'm not mistaken, where it's not accessible in the passenger compartment of the vehicle. So the only way that a law enforcement officer would even see it would be with a search warrant, right?
Well, if the officer is searching the vehicle for some other reason, if they stop the person for a legitimate reason and then are searching the vehicle incident to that stop, that might be one possibility. But again, I don't think, the city is going to vigorously argue public safety here. I personally don't think it's a particularly strong public safety rationale, but on the other hand, it's not a particularly burdensome restriction. And so when you have that kind of situation, who has the burden really matters a lot, right? So if the government wins unless the plaintiff shows a really substantial burden, it's going to be much easier in the government. But if it's vice versa and the plaintiff wins, unless the government can really prove public safety, then it's going to be much easier for the plaintiff.
I want to thank you both for being with us. Jamal Green, Columbia University Law School professor. Eugene Volokh, UCLA Law School professor. You can share your comments about the Second Amendment case. The Supreme Court agreed to hear. Yesterday, they made that announcement coming up later this term. The High Court takes it on. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Much more to come in the second hour. Tell you about it in just 1 minute.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a doctorate of education in organizational leadership, developing graduates with the knowledge and ability to transform organizations for optimal success and growth, offering an online hybrid format in West LA, with attendance only twice per term, tailored for working professionals. Classes start September. Apply by February 18th to be considered for a $3,000 scholarship opportunity at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Southern California, the home of Hollywood, Dodgers, Disneyland. Sometimes it feels like paradise. But any second now, that could change. Because a big earthquake is coming.
This will happen. There's no likelihood of it not happening. We are not stopping plate tectonics.
When the earthquake hits, our world will be shaken. So what can you do to prepare? I'm Jacob Margolis, host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope you're having a very good start to your day. Maybe you're heading out to get an early start on lunch. We're delighted to have you with us. We have a great hour to talk about, including something fascinating taking place up atop Mount Wilson, something I had no idea about, and Facebook is involved. What could that be? We'll find out more coming up later this hour. But first, as promised, one of the things I wanted to go a little bit deeper into coming out of the strike involving L.A. teachers and L.A. Unified is, you know, 6 days after teachers on the picket line and some people crossing the picket line and you know, all the potential for hard feelings coming out of that. If you have been in a workplace where there was a labor management dispute, how did you deal with the emotional aftermath of that? Didn't have to be a formal strike, didn't have to be a formal lockout, didn't have to actually be picket lines that individuals crossed, but fundamental differences between employees or between employees and management. How did you resolve that? Whether it was back in 1989 when LA Unified teachers were off the job for 9 days striking, and there was a lot of very bitter discord between teachers after that. I was a student back in the 1970s in the LA district, and there was still dispute and teachers frozen out after the labor dispute that happened, what was it, 69-70 school year. So I'd like to hear from you. Again, this isn't just schools, but if any workplace you've been in where there's been a deeply contentious difference between management and labor, what happened after there was that dispute, and how was it resolved? 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Could be private sector jobs, utility companies that have had strikes. When you've had labor management discord, what were some of the negative feelings that lingered, and then how were those resolved? 866-893-5722. With me is Evelyn Aleman, who is a parent of a freshman at Grover Cleveland, which is a high school in Reseda. It's an L.A. Unified-operated charter. She's also a teacher's assistant back during the 1989 LAUSD strike. Evelyn, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Larry.
So what was it like after the 89 strike for you? Because I was on the air at the time, and there were a lot of pretty nasty stories that came out of that. What did you experience?
Yeah, well, I was a TA, as you just stated, and I was about 19 years old. I was a student at Cal State Los Angeles, and I was assigned to Rosemont Elementary, which is in the Rampart area, my community as well. My husband, who was my boyfriend back then, came from Echo Park. He was also a teacher's assistant. And when we didn't know, we'd never, you know, known, we didn't know anything about a strike. When we showed up to the school that morning because we carpooled, there was a lot of yelling, a lot of heckling. It was very, very disruptive, combative. And I think, you know, it was an immigrant community going through so many challenges. And it was, I think, quite frightening for some of the parents and the students as well.
Well, and your husband, if I'm not mistaken, you mentioned he was a TA, and he was thinking of going into education as a teacher. How did the aftermath of the strike affect that decision?
Well, actually, we were both thinking of going into education, but because of that, I think, you know, we just kind of had to reevaluate our decision because, again, we were assisting, tutoring, mentoring students in a low-income community that was so vulnerable. People were fleeing the wars in Central America and El Salvador and Guatemala. So we already knew that this community was facing so much. So to then see that and to see the division between the teachers and the rest of the staff, that was really hard. And at that point, I think we both decided, you know, maybe this wasn't for us.
I'd love to hear from any teaching assistants who are off today in LA Unified. Maybe you're part-time, you're not in the classroom right now, but listening. Do you have any concerns about that rancor continuing between teachers and administrators? Does it change the relationship with TAs, or is that a warm enough relationship that even though TAs are on the job and teachers aren't, that doesn't create a problem? 866-893-KPCC. That's 866-893-5722. Or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Evelyn, when you were a teaching assistant back in 89, did you talk with teachers who maybe didn't support the strike but still went out, or those who actually crossed picket lines at that time?
Yeah, absolutely. The teacher who I was working for at the time, in fact, did cross the picket line. And I asked her, because I think a lot of I was a TA, so a lot of the other TAs were asking me, why is your teacher crossing the picket line? So I did ask her, and she said to me, you know, look at my students. She said, they need me more inside the classroom than out there. And that was the end of that. She was a tough cookie, and she stood by that. And she paid dearly for it because it would be hard for me to ask for supplies and either receive the supplies or get them in a timely manner in the aftermath of the strike. Or I would see her eating in her room. She couldn't eat in the lunchroom because she would be kind of given this cold shoulder, isolated. So she chose to often just eat in her room. And that went on for a very, very long time. I mean, I was a TA, and eventually I moved on from the school, but I did hear from, you know, friends who are longtime educators that who went through that strike who said those relationships were broken for years. So the impact went much deeper than just the 9-day strike that we had at the time.
Well, it's understandable because for someone to really forego pay, to go out on strike, you have to fully buy in. And it's a very, it's an emotional process, obviously, when people are gonna strike and go off the job because of the sacrifice that's involved in that. And when you see someone who you know, doesn't agree with that, a different conclusion, you're fully bought in emotionally, obviously that's challenging. Did the campus where your work try to deal with this? Did administrators try and do it? Do you remember, did UTLA have any sort of forums or any ways to talk through this in the aftermath, or were the individual teachers left to their own devices to deal with the painful feelings?
You know, I don't remember, quite frankly, if we had any types of conversations after. Let me put it this way. I think I would remember if we did, but being a TA, you know, I was there for about maybe about 4.5 hours a day, and then I was off to college. But I don't know if the teachers were able to have some kind of a conversation to help them heal. I know as a TA, I wasn't offered that, so which is why I was so concerned about it happening again this time.
Love to hear if you were an LA Unified teacher back in 89 or any other district in which there's been a strike over the past couple or more decades. How did you deal with the aftermath of that and the painful feelings between members of the bargaining unit, between teachers and administrators, if you were in another job, either the private or public sector where there was a job action? How did you deal with the differences of opinions? For example, University of California and the Medical Center, there have been job actions involving the nursing staff. If you were a part of that, what did you see in the aftermath in terms of relations between staff members there, and what, if anything, was done to try and you know, get people back pulling the same end of the rope once the labor issue was resolved? 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. We're talking with Evelyn Aleman, who is a parent of a freshman at Grover Cleveland High School in Reseda. It's operated by LA Unified, but a charter magnet school. And she was a teacher's assistant back in LA Unified in 1989 at the time of the last strike, that one lasting 9 days. Have you had many conversations with your child's teachers at Grover Cleveland?
Not during the strike. You know, my child did go to school throughout the 6-day period. She did wear red. So we tried to compromise together as a family. We understood that the district would be losing money if our child didn't go to school, because that's how they get, you know, state funds. But at the same time, my daughter felt like she really wanted to support her teachers. And we also were of the same feeling. So she dressed in red, but she went to school. So it was very difficult for her. It was very difficult for all of us. But again, having been through the strike 30 years ago, we kind of had a little bit of a different perspective. We were more concerned about, you know, the not just the lack of instruction, but what it would be like, what that experience would be like, and what feelings it would evoke for both my husband and I again. So we were concerned for her. We were concerned for the school community. But in the end, everything went smoothly. And I think it worked for us.
I remember when I was a student back in the 70s, again, immediately after that labor action, and teachers were still talking about it in the classroom and still angry at the saying negative things about it. And when you were a teaching assistant back in 89, did the teacher you work for, or any of the other teachers, talk with the students about, you know, what had gone on and their feelings about the thing?
You know, the teacher I worked for was very interesting, because she was just all about her class, very protective, like, just a mom to her students. And these were mostly, you know, these were English learners, and they were all immigrant children. They were, so they spoke Spanish, and I think they were like kindergarten. And so she, you know, just handled everything. You know, it was like learning as usual, basically. So they went to school. They got their lesson, and everything. She kept everything as normal as she possibly could. So we didn't have that conversation at all in our classroom. Even though the yelling was going on outside, we tried to make everything normal for the children. And in my husband's case, he had, you know, fifth grade. So it was a little bit different. He actually spoke with the kids and tried to get their perspective. How do you feel about this? And he tried to, you know, provide as much support as he could. Again, Larry, we were both college students.
Yeah.
We were kids ourselves, you know, living in a very difficult environment, challenging environment, neighborhood, I should say, at that time, trying to be of support to these children who were even younger.
And you know, it's funny, you mentioned we're just you and your husband kids at the time, but it obviously left a big imprint on you going through this whole process. And now as a parent, kind of, you know, reliving aspects of this, although this a shorter strike and a deal reached sooner, fortunately. Evelyn, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts as both a parent and a former teaching assistant in LA Unified, comparing and contrasting the emotions that were raised by the two separate actions. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Larry.
We appreciate it. Evelyn Olliman, parent of a freshman, Grover Cleveland, and former teaching assistant, 1989, the LA Unified School District. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up in just a minute, we'll take a look at a proposal from Governor Gavin Newsom to take the state youth correctional department out of the Department of Justice and put those juvenile services, law enforcement, into the Health and Human Services Agency to treat youthful offenders differently. We'll hear the pros and cons of that if the state decides to go that route. You're listening to Air Talk on KPCC. We'll be back in just 1 minute. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us. Governor Gavin Newsom proposed yesterday to change the way that the state's juvenile prisons and facilities are overseen. He says that the cost is ludicrous to keep the facilities open as the per offender cost has skyrocketed. This as way fewer young people are in state custody, many more of them at the county level now. So the governor is asking members of the state legislature to put youth custodial facilities under the State Department of Health and Human Services. Joining us to talk about the reason for that, what the pros and cons are, Kate Chatfield, Policy Director for Restore Justice, a nonprofit that advocates for criminal justice reform. She also teaches at University of San Francisco School of Law. Kate Chatfield, thank you for joining us. First, let's give a little bit of historic context. I was surprised that there are so few young people that are in state custody. What, 600 some?
Yes. I believe it's in the neighborhood of 600 now, and that's down from 10,000 in 2007. So there's been a dramatic decline in the population at the Department of Juvenile Justice, and that has come about because of two things. First, violent crime and youth crime is down in California as it is nationwide. And the second thing is that in 2007, the California legislature did what's known as juvenile justice realignment. And for all but the most serious offenses, they shifted the cost and the care of youths to the counties. So in other words, the counties could treat their youth in the community, at group homes, at ranches, at camps, but in, you know, with some sort of a less of a imprisonment or a less of a custodial environment. And so that, and the state gave the counties money to effect this change, and that has resulted in a great decrease in our juvenile population that's incarcerated at the Department of Juvenile Justice.
Then what's the profile of those in state custody? Are these the most egregious offenders?
Well, they're the offenders that have committed what we call in the adult world as strikes. So this is, you know, it can be murder, attempted murder, kidnapping, rape, certain kinds of sex crimes. So these are in the Welfare and Institutions Code, it's 707B crimes. So these are definitely, you know, more serious crimes. Of course, I want to also say that these are whatever the nature of the offenses, these are the offenders that have been determined by a juvenile court to be amenable to rehabilitation so that they don't go on into the adult system.
Okay. So does that mean that they're released once they reach adulthood? Or are you saying that there are certain particularly egregious offenders, that the crimes are particularly horrible, that they go immediately into adult? Because I didn't realize juveniles commingled with adults in custody.
They commingle, but at the age of 16, there can be a fitness hearing, and the juvenile court now, after Prop 57, can transfer that 16 or 17-year-old to adult court.
But they wouldn't serve their time in an adult facility then?
Not until they reach the age of adulthood.
Okay. So when you're talking about these 600 then, I just want to make sure I follow. This 600 plus are the ones due to be released upon reaching adulthood at the latest?
No. The age of 25. The Department of Juvenile Justice can keep them until the age of 25. And even after that, there are some, and it's detailed, and there are some provisions for continued civil commitment.
Okay. All right. So, and this then is a distinct population from those who would not, because of the nature of their crimes, would not be released at 25. Is that right?
They would be released.
Okay.
Potentially released at 25 if they're not the subject of further civil commitment.
Okay, and who determines whether they're subject to further commitment?
That's in the sort of a youth Department of Juvenile Justice, a parole. I'm going to call it like a parole hearing or something, but I'm not sure that that's it's not.
But it essentially works the same way. It's a judgment call about where the person's at in rehabilitation. Kate Chatfield with us of Restore Justice, Policy Director of the nonprofit. Also with us is Patricia Song, Director of Youth Justice Policy with the Children's Defense Fund California. That's also a nonprofit, children's rights advocacy. Ms. Song, thank you for being with us. As a practical matter, what would this really mean for the young offenders in state custody? How would their experience change?
That's a great question. And I think that's one of the many questions on practitioners, advocates, I'm sure government agencies' minds. While a great idea, and this signals a shift in orientation away from punitive approaches that we've relied on for decades. That's how we got to the population of over 10,000 in DJJ at one point, towards something oriented towards developing whole, healthy young people through alternative systems that we have really under-resourced in many ways, education, health, other basic supports. So, you know, this is not a new experiment, maybe for California, but some of the 40 other states, some very recently, Arkansas, New York, Ohio, have created new homes for juvenile justice systems, including their state's lockup systems. So government and community partners have to deal with what does this look like in implementation? Imbuing top leadership down to staff who work with young people every day, providing them the training and supports to treat young people very differently.
What does that mean from a public safety standpoint? So let's say you have a young offender convicted of murder or rape or kidnapping, and that individual is in a locked facility operated by the state of California Juvenile Justice Department. How would it change? Would they still be in locked custody if the Health and Human Services Agency takes over? Would they be putting them into some sort of managed group home environment where there might be greater odds the young person's able to walk away? How, again, you know, from public safety, how would this affect?
Sure. I'm making some assumptions here because we don't know what the details and implementation look like, but based on what other states have done, I assume that the facilities will look like locked facilities, but the management, the mission statements, the training, the protocols, the day-to-day expectations of staff may look very different, right? That the research has borne out in the last couple decades that we have to take a less punishment approach to young people and really think about the underlying causes of their delinquency and criminal behaviors and support them in a different way. So from a public safety standpoint, the health and human services orientation should really serve that better than it has in recent years.
We're talking with Patricia Song of the Children's Defense Fund California. We reached out to the California District Attorney Association to see what the DA's thought about this. They've not yet taken a position because the organization said they just don't have enough details on what would be involved in implementing the governor's proposal. So presumably, if and when this takes the form of a bill in the legislature, the DA's would come out with a position on this. But with us from the Chief Probation Officers of California, obviously you're concerned about the implications for them, the President, Stephanie James. Ms. James, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
What are your concerns about the potential for Health and Human Services taking on the custody responsibility for young offenders?
Well, as previously indicated, you know, the juvenile population has significantly decreased in the last 10 years. And the local probation department have been invested in by the state starting in 2007. And we've made significant strides in implementing evidence-based programs and making sure that we have services and supports that are provided to our youth so that as they leave our care, they are successful returning to the community. And so our biggest concerns is just making sure that all of the progress that has been made in the last decade doesn't backslide. We want to make sure that, you know, these youth that are being served by the state are the highest risk, highest need individuals. And that's why they are sent to the state, because locally we don't have the resources to serve them. And so, like everyone else kind of indicated, we don't have enough details of the proposal at this point. But we are cautiously optimistic because we think it could be a good thing for the youth and for the juvenile justice system as a whole. However, we just need to make sure that the operational details make sure that we continue to ensure that these youth are being provided proper evidence-based programming and supports while they're in custody so that they can be successful upon their return to the community.
And how does that play out? I would assume that significant numbers of these teenagers, they're not just lone actors, but that often it's a part of group activity. They're members of gangs. The criminal acts are carried out in groups or at least with some connection to organized criminal or organized violent activity. How currently does the Department of Juvenile Justice try to deal with that sort of group dynamic of a young person potentially released to a community where the gang is still an influence? How might that potentially change if it's under HHS?
Yeah. Well, I think that's a good question because it is unknown. And I can't speak specifically to the programs and services that are being provided at the current DJJ. However, what I do know is that they have contracted with local experts, similar to what we've contracted with here in San Joaquin County, to actually develop specialized programs to provide to those youth so that they can change their antisocial thinking and values and beliefs and really start addressing their risk factors and their needs. And that helps change their mindset so that they, when they return back into the community, they'll be better positioned to make, you know, better, more pro-social decisions.
I welcome your calls as a listener to Air Talk. What do you think about Governor Gavin Newsom's proposal that would require legislative action to take the 600-some California juvenile offenders who have been convicted of the most serious crimes, take them from out of the Division of Juvenile Justice in the state, put them under the responsibility of the State Health and Human Services Department? We're at 866-893. KPECC. That's 866-893-5722. Perhaps you have a teenage offender who is a family member or a friend. You have thoughts about this. Perhaps someone in your family or you yourself have been a victim of a crime that's been perpetrated by a teen offender. Your thoughts about this and as a practical matter, what it means for the youth in custody as well as for public safety. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, KPCC.org. Let me go back to Kate Chatfield, Policy Director for Restore Justice. In terms of practically implementing this, what do you think HHS would need to do to take on this responsibility?
You know, as far as the procedural details as to what HHS would need to do, I think your other speakers are right. I mean, the devil is in the details, and we'll have to see how they would shift from what the DJJ, the Department of Juvenile Justice, has been doing. I do want to note that the Department of Juvenile Justice, since juvenile realignment and since, you know, a lawsuit in 2004 against what was then known as the California Youth Authority, The Department of Juvenile Justice has really taken on a very rehabilitative aspect to, as I, you know, to the wards in their care. It was horrible before under the California Youth Authority. And in fact, there was, you know, a Los Angeles Times article that was, you know, calling it a graveyard for our youth, a junkyard for young lives. And so there has been a remarkable shift in what the Department of Juvenile Justice has done. How that will change with the Department of Health and Human Services, again, you know, the devil's in the details.
Well, but this particular subsection, isn't there a high recidivism rate for these offenders?
The recidivism rate has also gone down as they are getting treatment. And there's been some good trauma-informed care, and that's the hope. I mean, a juvenile judge has said that these offenders are amenable to rehabilitation, and that's why we're not going directly into the adult court. We're going to do treatment and do care in the juvenile system.
Governor Newsom, in his call for this yesterday, said the current system isn't working, with 3 out of 4 young offenders arrested again within 3 years of their release. More than half are convicted of new crimes, and more than a third back in state custody. The governor is saying, if we're going to change the criminal justice system, let's start at the feeder system, which is the juvenile justice system. We're going to continue our conversation about Governor Newsom's proposal. We're at 866-893-KPECC. Back after a live update from Hetty Lynn Hurdies. A subsidiary of Facebook is looking at constructing a facility on top of Mount Wilson to do research. And it's pretty interesting. We'll talk about that in just a few minutes. But right now, we're talking about a proposal from Governor Newsom yesterday that the 600-some juvenile offenders who were in state custody, these for the most serious of charges, murder, kidnapping, rape. These are not the ones that end up in county custody for lesser offenses, but the most serious offenders, moving them from the Department of Juvenile Justice for the state of California to the Health and Human Services Agency of the state. So what would that mean? What would the custodial facilities be like? Would they change at all? What sorts of programs for the teen offenders? How would that change as well? What sort of effect might it have on, once they're released from custody, their lives back in their home communities? Our phone lines are open for you at 866-893-KPECC. Cheryl in Reseda. Cheryl, thank you for joining us. Your thoughts on this?
Well, I'm very concerned because it reminds me of the switch that was made for mental health back when Ronald Reagan was president. And those people ended up, a lot of them are on the streets now without any place to live or what have you, because they just can't deal with society. And so If the governor is going to do this, I think he really needs to have money in that budget for their homeless, for their home.
Cheryl, I appreciate the call. Yeah, what you're referring to, of course, is under the Lanterman Act in California, the closing of facilities where those with mental health problems were put into large-scale facilities. That the determination was that this was really an infringement on the rights of people dealing with mental illness. So the idea was that there would be community mental health clinics that would fill that place, and people would not be forcibly kept in what essentially were asylum-like environments. But the money was not allocated for those community-based mental health services. Let me go back to Patricia Song of the Children's Defense Fund, California. Are we talking about potential changes in the release of these offenders?
That's certainly one of the practices that would come under this new agency and the administrative
protocols that govern it. I want to go back to, I think, a comment that you made, and I think what the community member is raising, which is, if we're going to look at an opportunity to change the feeder system that often channels young people into the adult criminal justice system, we have to recognize that DJJ is just one component of California's juvenile justice system. Right. So that means that the vast majority of young people are going to come home, that they are actually mostly interfacing with local county systems. So while there's, you know, some 600 young people in DJJ, there's some 40,000 young people at the local level in county probation systems and other juvenile justice systems at the local level. So this idea of young people existing in a family, young people and families existing in a community means we do have to look at how we invest in whole communities, right? Why do gangs exist? What the economy of those gangs are? What other job opportunities exist? In LA alone, it costs about $175,000 to incarcerate a young person for a year. So certainly changing DJJ is key. And then also thinking about the system along a continuum, right, both local and state, going home after some sort of incarceration is really important.
All right. So what happens when these offenders are released, often at age 25, they're no longer held, even if they've been convicted of very serious crimes. Kate Chatfield of Restore Justice, do they get support? I mean, for example, you know, kids who grow up in foster care, one of the real, you know, problems is they'll come out of a group home or foster family environment at age 18, and they're very limited resources, and all of a sudden they're on their own. Does that happen for some of these who've spent, you know, years, their childhood essentially incarcerated?
Absolutely. Absolutely that happens, and that's why we need to invest in reentry services for these people who are coming back home and who are coming to our communities. I mean, just like we need to invest in rehabilitation when they're inside, we have to make sure that they have reentry services so that we can cut down that recidivism rate. There can be some housing.
Would it be easier to provide it, in your view, if they've been in the custody of the Department of Health and Human Services instead of the Juvenile Justice Department? Does that make it easier for the post-incarcerated support services to be delivered?
There has to be for those reentry services, whether it's coming through DJJ or whether it's coming from the Department of Health and Human Services. There has to be a commitment to, you know, from the state for those reentry services, whether those people come out at the age of 25, whether they come out at the age of 35 or 45 or later. We have to, if we want to end recidivism, we're going to have to make the smart financial decision to provide for reentry services so people aren't, as the caller said, aren't ending up homeless.
Let me go back to Stephanie James, who's the president of the Chief Probation Officers of California. Ms. James, what do you think would be the biggest contributor to cutting this high recidivism rate for the most serious offenders?
Well, one of the reasons probation has been so successful in the last decade at addressing juvenile justice has been because we are independent. And so we can understand the governor's desire to separate DJJ out from under the adult correctional system, because that's what we do here locally. And we're able to be in that unique role where we're the cog in the wheel that touches all the other points in the system to ensure that all services are being provided to the youth that we're serving. And this includes behavioral health, education, workforce development, rehabilitative programming. Probation knows there's been research upon research about the 8 principles of effective intervention. And if that you actually can implement these 8 principles, you will be effective at reducing recidivism. And so those are things that the governor is going to have to take into consideration when he looks at shifting DJJ to Health and Human Services. And because we are experts in this area, we're definitely willing and interested in lending our expertise, because our biggest concern is we want to make sure that the needs of these youth are being met so that when they are returned to the community, they're successful, but also that we're protecting public safety at the same time.
Want to thank you all for being with us. That's Stephanie James, also with us, Patricia Song and Kate Chatfield. You can share your comments about Governor Newsom's proposal to take the responsibility for the 600-plus youths who are in custody under the state's juvenile justice system and put them under the control of the Health and Human Services Agency. You can do that on the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Coming up right after Air Talk, Terry Gross in Fresh Air speaks with former San Quentin inmate Erlon Woods. He tells his story and the stories of his fellow inmates on the podcast Ear Hustle. After 21 years in prison, Governor Jerry Brown freed Erlon Woods just a couple of months ago. That's Fresh Air with Terry Gross coming up at noon here on 89.3. Coming up, we'll talk about a subsidiary of Facebook's plans for the top of Mount Wilson overlooking the San Gabriel Valley. It's Air Talk on KPCC. Back in just a minute. Well, things in D.C. continue day by day. The discord between President Trump and Democrats. The president indicating earlier that he intended to give a State of the Union address before a joint session of Congress sometime next week. And House Speaker Nancy Pelosi just said the House will not pass a resolution for the State of the Union until the government is reopened, essentially telling President Trump his speech is not authorized to be made to a joint session of Congress. So more to come, I'm sure, the top of the hour from NPR News right here on 89.3 KPCC. Well, as I mentioned earlier, a subsidiary of Facebook is looking to build two observatories atop Mount Wilson. What would these observatories do? With us from the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers publication, as well as science and tech writer for The Economist, Wired, and The Guardian, Mark Harris. Mark wrote for the IEEE's publication, Facebook's Plans for Space Lasers Revealed. Mark, thank you for joining us. So what is this Facebook subsidiary looking at potentially doing atop the mountain?
Well, we're not entirely sure, but we do know that the subsidiary is building a satellite. And then reading between the lines, seeing what some of the people in the LA offices are working on, it seems pretty clear they're building a laser communication system. So it'd be normally satellites use radio signals to transmit to ground stations and back up to orbit. So this would be one of the first commercial companies to build a laser communication system where they would fire laser beams up to satellites on orbit to exchange data and information.
Fascinating. So Point View Tech is the name of the subsidiary, and they operate out in Northridge, is that right?
That's right. Facebook has an organization there called Facebook Connectivity Lab, which, as the name suggests, works on all kinds of connectivity projects. They do cabling for remote and rural places. And one of their big messages or one of their big aims is to connect the unconnected. You know, about half the world has never gone online on the internet. And so the Facebook's aim is to try and get those people online with the aim of, you know, helping them start businesses, improve communication and that kind of thing.
Now, there is satellite internet, of course. HughesNet is one of the companies here in the U.S. that offers that to rural areas. What are some of the differences in speed and efficiency of a laser-distributed internet via satellite versus the current method?
Right. So, I mean, so with radio signals, as you know, obviously being at a radio station, you know, these are broadcast signals. It's very hard to focus a radio signal to an exact point. And so that means for a start, you're using a lot of energy you don't need to use to get to the people you want. A lot of the energy in a radio signal is wasted. And then also you can interfere with other radio stations, right? You can't have two radio stations on the same frequency, you know, nearby each other. With lasers, you kind of get over both problems. It's a really efficient way of encoding information. And all of the energy on that beam is in the beam itself. It doesn't interfere with other lasers or other radio signals. And so that means you can make much smaller satellites. And that means they're cheaper to launch. and, you know, and the data can be faster. So there's a lot of advantages to it.
Well, and what about the reception of, would you, you know, there's a dish, obviously, for current satellite distributed internet. What's the reception, the receiving device from the satellite? What does it look like?
Right. And so that's what we think they're building up on Mount Wilson, an observatory. It's just what it sounds like. I mean, it's basically an optical system like a telescope. It's obviously not focusing on the stars, but it would line up with the satellite and the, you know, the laser beam would come into the optics and then that would, you know, then get decoded. So you need an observatory because the observatory itself has to shine a laser beam up to space that the satellite looks for, like a wider angle laser beam. And then that satellite locks onto the beam and starts, you know, you can start beaming data to and fro at that point, unless it's cloudy. Obviously, these aren't lasers, like these aren't supremely powerful lasers that could hurt you. But so in fact, even a cloud could interfere with the signals.
And I'm just trying to understand if you're talking about a home consumer getting a laser distributed internet signal, what kind of a device picks up that laser transmission in the home?
Yeah, that's not going to happen anytime soon. For a system like this would be perhaps they would put one of the observatories in a small town that hasn't got any other cabling or other wireless systems, and the laser would beam to that. So it would be a centralized system that would then get distributed to a community. So you can make these observatories quite small, you know, perhaps even like a suitcase size. Right now, it's still at the experimental stage, and it's not something you would have a telescope on your smartphone or anything like that.
Well, and so that would seem of limited utility, though, because even small towns in America, you know, typically get internet access. The real challenge is for the rural people where, you know, getting it wired out, it's not cost effective to run the cabling out to them from the nearest community. It sounds like this wouldn't solve that issue.
Right. I mean, it's still an experimental stage. I mean, Facebook's stated motive is not to make a commercial service, perhaps for people in America, but it's to enable communities in developing countries to get some kind of access. And so you can imagine that something like this in a small community in Africa or somewhere in Asia where there's really nothing, but people still live quite close together. So that's one thing. But the same technology could be used between satellites in space, and then we could see the advantage of that. SpaceX, Elon Musk's space company, is planning a network of satellites that use lasers between the satellites in space. And that would just mean everything gets down to your home satellite dish much faster, right? Because the laser system in space would be a much quicker way than today's current satellite technology.
We're talking with science and tech writer Mark Harris. He writes for a number of publications, quite recently for the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers, their publication on Facebook subsidiaries' plans. PointView Tech is the company for having these two observatories atop Mount Wilson that would enable testing of laser directed communications with a satellite to see what the viability is of internet distribution via satellite using lasers because of the higher efficiency than using radio frequencies. Mark, any idea the timeline of this for the construction of the observatories and the testing?
Right. So it looks from construction permits as though the observatories are pretty much built. The satellite that PointView Tech is building, well, that's kind of a bit of a victim of the federal shutdown at the moment. The Federal Communication Commission gives permits for people to launch satellites because they're worried about things like interference with radio signals. And the satellite that PointView Tech is building currently hasn't got its launch permit. The company said it wants to launch sometime in 2019. So I think we're probably looking at sort of later in the year, perhaps.
All right. Very good. Mark Harris, thank you so much for sharing this about the Facebook subsidiary PointView Tech, based in Southern California. And they're building atop Mount Wilson, the two observatories. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Mark Harris, science and tech writer with us on Air Talk. Libby Dankman will be sitting in for me tomorrow hosting Air Talk. I have a family commitment that I'll be attending to tomorrow. Then I'll be back with you Friday for Air Talk and for Film Week as well. Have a terrific afternoon. Fresh Air with Terry Gross is next. And then Take Two, it's brand new 2 o'clock time slot with A. Martinez coming up this afternoon right here on 89.3. Have a great afternoon.